It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania Senate returned to session Monday and faces a busy schedule dealing with everything from amendments to the public school code to proposed changes to the election code. Jay Costa is the Senate Democratic leader and joins us now. Welcome, Senator.
Well, thanks for having me, Kevin. Happy to be with you.
Last week, Senate President Pro Tem Jake Corman on the confluence said he fully accepts the results of the November election. Quote, yes, I mean, Joe Biden has been certified as the president of the United States, obviously by the state, end quote. But he and other Republicans are continuing their pursuit of an election audit. Briefly, what are your thoughts on that effort?
Well, I think it's a bad idea, and we've been fighting the release of this information for several weeks now. I recognize that Senator Corman has indicated that he believes that President Biden won the election. And by the way, 25 state senators won in that same election on that same ballot. But at the end of the day, the actions that they're taking through the Senate Intergovernment Operations Committee show something different. They're looking to get the Social Security numbers, as we know, driver's license, and even the ballots of people who voted, 7 million records, and put them in the hands of a third party that we don't know who they are. And certainly, we believe that that whole process is fraught with concern about the potential for the release of that information. We have to take steps to stop this conversation about how this process didn't work. It was a safe and secure electoral process, in our view. There are a number of things that we should be focusing on if we're going to talk about election reforms, not looking about what happened before, but moving forward.
Such as?
Think something called pre-canvassing. We put together an election law advisory committee, which was put into Act 12 when we did it a couple years ago. They recommended something called pre-canvassing, whether it be 3, 4, 5, or 7 days in advance. Folks can open the ballots and scan them through something, but not tabulate them, but only scan them through. Position them to be, you hit the button at a certain hour and those ballots will be counted, and it expedites the process. Drop-off security, looking to make sure if we're going to have drop boxes in our communities, that we have a level of security associated with that. One of the things that has been a sticking point has been something related to voter identification. And while I recognize that folks have a concern about that, I do think that there's a level of identification that we can come to consensus on, but not the very narrow, restrictive, and prescribed documents that they prescribe as being the only way that you can have approval to go vote in a voting place.
Let's move on to some other legislation. During this session, you have proposed bills on everything from the nuances of rent relief to a study on housing and health to hate crimes. What is your top priority?
Certainly trying to address the issue around hate crimes is something that we had introduced many, many years ago, even prior to the Tree of Life situation. But what came out of that was, again, a recognition that we needed to address those measures going forward. And to allow the Attorney General, for example, to collect data about hate crime groups across Pennsylvania and sharing that information with local law enforcement folks. But there are a number of other things that we want to talk about. I think the whole conversation about climate change needs to be something that we have to, that will come to fruition, not next day or so, but next week when we're in Harrisburg, and we'll deal with the regulations that came out of the Independent Regulatory Review Commission, that they approved these regulations to move Pennsylvania forward. There's an attempt to disapprove those regulations, and that'll be a very controversial question as well.
Let me follow up on the hate crime legislation. I noticed that there are few Republicans co-sponsoring these bills. So how do you create consensus for your legislation?
You know, it's been tough, and I think that we have to make the argument and let the data demonstrate to us that we need to make these changes and that they're warranted on some of the other measures. It's just a function of trying to convince our colleagues that these make sense and that we need to advance these measures going through the process. This October 27th, it's going to remind us that we have to take action in this space. And that's one of the things that we're working to look at.
Earlier this year, Governor Wolf proposed a plan for charter school reform that he says will save more than $200 million a year. The plan would update the funding formula that assigns how much money for special ed charter schools get and create a standard tuition for cyber charters. Some Republicans have proposed their own version of charter school reform. Senator Martin of Lancaster County introduced legislation to take away the power of local school boards to approve or reject charter school applications. Where do you stand on the matter? Are you planning to support either of these ideas from the governor or the Republicans?
I've been a longtime supporter of charter school reform. certainly in the funding formula for our cyber charter schools that the governor's proposed, but also many of the other changes that it put forth regarding a number of other issues. I do not want to see, and I do not support Senator Martin's version that would remove the school districts from that process. At the end of the day, the school districts are the ones that are paying the lion's share of charter school costs. And quite frankly, if you talk to any of the school districts in Allegheny County and across this Commonwealth, particularly those that have a number of charter schools in those areas, they're paying a significant portion of their revenue, both their local revenue and their state revenue, that's being diverted away from the school district itself and to charter schools without the same level of accountability that our public schools have right now.
Throughout this year, there's been a lot of reporting about per diems and how much money our state elected officials collect through these. Senator Brewster, your colleague from Allegheny County, this year put forward Senate Bill 362, which would ban per diems, instead only allow for actual reimbursements. You're one of the co-sponsors. It's been sitting in the state government committee since March. Do you think it will ever get voted out of committee?
You know, I hope so. I think we have to have that conversation. I will tell you, just last week, I had a conversation with Senator Cormann about a number of these issues, lobbying reform, as he's been working on. And I've indicated that I'd like to mirror and match lobbying reform with campaign finance reform that I've been working on for 10 years. So I said, I'm willing to stand together with you. You talk about lobbying reform, I'll talk about campaign finance reform. And we also talked about some of these other measures that are there, that being one of them, the per diem reform. So I'm optimistic that maybe something can come from that. But the only way we do it is if we get bipartisan support. Right now, Senator Brewster's legislation, which has been around for a number of years, is not in a place yet to be able to do that. That's disappointing.
That's a lot. That's a lot of reform. Do you think one is more likely than another? Or it's like, okay, you come to consent or compromise on a whole package of reforms?
I'm hopeful we can come together on a whole package of reforms. That was my communication to my colleague, Senator Cormann. But I think because they are the majority, a party, I believe that they will likely advance what they believe is going to be something that they can maybe get passed in the House as well, which might just be the lobbying reform. There's four bills associated with that. We believe that there need to be some modifications and additions to that to make it more strict in terms of what lobbyists can do. For example, lobbyists should not be able to run campaigns for a campaign for a senator or House member and then turn around and start lobbying them, you know, the day after they take office. We have to have that separation, in my view, and that's one of the things that we'll be pursuing going forward.
Jay Costa is the Senate Democratic leader. Senator, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The board of the Urban Redevelopment Authority of Pittsburgh voted to enter into an option agreement to sell a vacant property in Beachview to Casa San Jose, a nonprofit whose goal was to help Latino immigrants thrive in Pittsburgh. Executive Director Monica Ruiz joins us now. Welcome back to The Confluence, Monica.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
You're purchasing a property just half a mile down from your current location. So what are your plans for this new location?
So Casa means home. Casa San Jose is the house of St. Joseph. And so for us, we really wanted to find a space where it was a place where people could come and congregate and have programming. Right now, the way that it's set up, we are in three different storefronts. So Casa is really transactional. People come in, they have a need, they get that need met, they leave. We really wanted a place where our community could be together. We can have programming there. Right now, we rent space at a church. We rent space Boys and Girls Club. We rent space all over the city so that we can provide space to have our programs. This will actually let us have space in the community. And this way, we can service not only our Latino community, but also our American neighbors.
So this will allow you to do things better than you currently do, the consolidation more efficiently?
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. Last week, we had so many people there that we actually had to put tables and chairs outside on the sidewalk where people would have like alternative meeting space to meet with the families that we serve because we simply do not fit there. So this will provide adequate meeting space to meet with individuals, to meet with groups, and to have things like our after-school programs actually inside the building. We do have satellite offices across the city and the county and outside of the county. We will continue to have those satellite offices to help reach the communities in those areas. But as far as the programmings that we provide out of the Beachview office, we will no longer need to rent anywhere else.
I believe those satellite locations are in East Liberty, Washington County, Ambridge, and Moon Township. You are remaining your main headquarters in the neighborhood of Beachview. Why is that important?
It is really important. We've been there for several years, and we've really made connections with the community. We want to be in the area because we want to make sure that folks can get services and resources where they live. You know, there are other areas in the city that have little pockets of the community as well. And so we're hoping that other organizations can house their offices in those areas. But in the meantime, we'll continue to have these satellite offices.
And Beachview does have a growing Latino community.
Absolutely. We sure do.
You'll be developing the property with the URA. How does that work? Will you both be contributing funds? What?
As of now, we did get some funds out of the ARP funds that came through the city. So those will be the initial funds that will go into it. And then we are raising money. You know, we're asking our local foundations to help. And we're also asking our donors, our community, our staff. We're all going to be raising funds in order to pay for the building.
Has your organization ever taken on a capital campaign like this one required for the development of the site?
We have not. We have not done anything quite like this. And I am learning every day how big of a project this is. But I'm super excited because if you think about the amount of resources and money that have been given to the Latino community in the city, it's really none. And so this is a great opportunity for the city to really prove that they do care about this growing population and provide resources so that we can better serve them.
You say you're super excited. What have you been hearing from people in the community? Are they super excited?
Absolutely. You know, we didn't go into this, you know, alone. We talked to the neighborhood communities, the neighborhood businesses, and got letters of support because this is for the community. Again, as much as, you know, the last year and a half has been absolutely terrible for everyone, we have been able to expand our programming. And now our program, we're a food pantry. And our food pantry isn't just for our Latino families that we serve. A lot of our American neighbors get services from that food pantry. And the hopes is that now once we have a space to host our after school programming and our weekend programming for the youth, that we'll have a lot more of our American neighbor children attending those services as well.
So when do you estimate finishing development and moving in?
The goal is to finish and move in by the end of next year. We do have a shell of a building, but there's a lot of work that needs to go in that building. It's been vacant for about 20 years or so. And so there's just a lot of work that needs to be done. And we want to make sure that we have a really great building that's going to last for a very, very long time because it's really right in the center of Beachview. And I really want it to be a strong staple for this community.
Monica Ruiz is the executive director of Casa San Jose. Monica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. During the Black Lives Matter and racial justice demonstrations last year, many of the messages heard on the streets reflected similar calls some five decades earlier. For some leaders in the civil rights movement, their impact made waves, but their name and history maybe not so well known. Keisha Blaine is an award-winning author, co-editor of the bestseller 400 Souls, and an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. Her new book is Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. Keisha, welcome back to The Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that you didn't discover Fannie Lou Hamer until you were a senior in college years after her death. Why don't as many people maybe know of her as much as other fighters for social and racial justice, whether they're Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, John Lewis, even Rosa Parks?
I think mainstream, narratives, certainly mainstream historical narratives, tend to overlook or at least marginalize the contributions of individuals like Hamer, who came from an impoverished background, individuals like Hamer who had limited formal education. She only had a sixth grade education. And there's so many aspects, I think, of Hamer's life and experience that differed greatly from a lot of the folks we tend to talk about. Yet, as I point out in this new book, it's, you know, all of these reasons that made her so impactful because people could relate to her. She was just a, you know, an ordinary, you know, activist committed to improving the lives of those around her.
So what impresses you, amazes you even the most about her? She didn't start her fight for voting rights for blacks until she was 44. She was a sharecropper, the daughter of sharecroppers, sixth grade education. She accomplished so much in a relatively short period. What amazes you?
So many things amaze me about Hamer. I think one of the traits that really stand out is what I describe in the book as her radical honesty. She's someone who simply spoke truth to power, spoke from her heart, told you how she felt, did not worry so much about your comfort level, your perspectives on, you know, she didn't worry about your feelings because she felt like it was so important to tell you the truth. And she would say it was important to tell it like it is.
Mm-hmm. Her activism began when she attended a meeting of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in 1962. Was it eye-opening for her? Blacks and whites think as I do? I have permission to say what I've been thinking maybe all along?
I think certainly it was the moment where, according to Hamer, she learned for the first time that she had the right to vote as a citizen of the United States. Of course, this was a meeting at a local church. Hamer was a person of faith. And for her, I think she saw what she believed was God's calling for her life.
Did she feel comfortable with the SNCC, the fact that maybe it was not really hierarchical? Anyone could be a leader in that group, and she obviously became a leader.
Yes, she really loved working with activists in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC, because, as I pointed out, she joined the movement much later in life. You know, it didn't make a difference to her. She didn't have a problem with being in a space with young people. In fact, she loved working with young people in all kinds of capacities. I think for her, she just appreciated the fact that they listened to her, and she spoke often about feeling like it was the first time someone took her ideas seriously. That's what she would later say about the activists in SNCC. And she just fit in.
Her passion, her candor drew the ire of many in her native Mississippi. She became a target. You write that she was detained by police after friends on a bus were hassled by police after returning from a voters' education gathering. She was severely beaten in that jail. The owner of the cotton plantation where she was a sharecropper said, "Give up your voter registration or leave," and so she left. Nothing seemed to deter her.
When you read about her experiences, I think certainly for me, there was a moment where I just had to pause because I thought to myself, how in the world could one person endure so much? But I think it goes back to that August 1962 meeting where she just had this awakening, you know, both a political and religious awakening. And I think because of those reasons, even when she grew discouraged, even when she encountered resistance, she kept pushing and pushing and pushing because she felt like this was what she was meant to do.
Just a couple of years after she began her activism, her words were heard across the nation. She spoke at the Democratic National Convention. Did Fannie Lou Hamer ask questions to not just maybe make us feel uncomfortable, but to look inward and ask ourselves whether liberty and justice for all truly meant for all?
Yes, I think one of the main reasons that she gave that powerful speech at the Democratic National Convention in 1964 was to simply point out American hypocrisy. I think Hamer wanted people to understand that life for Black people in the United States was very different than for other groups. She wanted to really show, you know, even though the U.S. Constitution claims, certainly in writing, that Black people are citizens of the United States, they are not being treated as such. They're not being given full access to the vote in particular. So she shed the light on voter suppression. She shed the light on state-sanctioned violence. And in the end, to emphasize what she saw as American hypocrisy.
The title of your book, Until I Am Free, comes from what Fannie Lou Hamer said, "You are not free, white or black, until I am free." What did she mean by that?
She wanted to emphasize, I think, to all Americans that we're part of this American polity. We are in this together. Of course, everyone may not accept this premise, but Hamer tried to emphasize that you cannot experience true liberation in your own life if someone else around you are in chains. It just doesn't work that way because we are connected. Our fates are connected. And so Hamer repeated this constantly to try to get people to really build this vision of an inclusive democracy.
Finally, she fought fiercely to educate people about their voting rights and to register them to vote. I wonder what she would have said about the ongoing battle today for voting rights.
I think Fannie Lou Hamer would be frustrated, as so many of us are, just looking at the ways that the Voting Rights Act in particular has been under attack. At the same time, I think she would say, we have to fight this. We have to fight this, because she understood, I think, more than anyone else, just the value of the vote, the importance of the vote. And so I think today, you know, she would look around, be disappointed about where we are, but yet still be emboldened to fight. That's just, I think, the spirit that she would want to convey, is that we have to keep fighting to protect these rights.
Keisha Blaine is an award-winning author, associate professor of history at Pitt, and the author of Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.